Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So I love the quote, time is motion, stillness is eternity. The solstice is there converging, so we want to step into the still point, the traveling now, as Escarina, the witch, calls it, where we're available to mystery. So it is the dark of the moon, the dark of the year, as the mythic is suffusing incarnational actuality. We will delve into these things. So more than perfectly, we welcome the return of Sophie Strand, author of The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine. Right in the opening lines, put down the sword and pick up the wand for ongoing solstice magic. Sophie Strand is a poet writer who syncretizes her vast Sagittarian inquiry, collages spiraling forth like her beloved mushroom spores into increasing cultural receptivity. Yes, it's true. Teasing all into pertinence to now, what does and shall our culture encourage in Mars, liberating Mars, setting it free, and discerning those intrinsic qualities that we most need now. Her website is sophiestrand.com. Welcome, Sophie.
Thank you so much for having me back. You know, it's absolutely insane to close the circle. I think I had only written 3 essays of that book when we first spoke.
No, it was adorable. Yeah, that's right. We last spoke on March 29th, 2021, I think that's right. And then I hosted you on radio on Trickster Council around then. And then look at your prolific spore production, prodigious, like holy moly. And here's your book that I increasingly want to spend more and more time with. And there's so many things that I love and so many ways to go. But I love your creative suspicion, detective work, about how have we been hoodwinked, snookered, and bamboozled. And it's so important, because if we are bamboozled mythically, we're more susceptible to being bamboozled politically in all realms,
indeed,
right?
So, yeah. We have to be slightly suspicious readers of both our culture and our dominant mythologies, the things we take to be fact. We need to look, we need to look under the car hood of these things.
Yeah, no, that's right. So what you elicited in me, I've been brewing on this too, because the mythological is suffusing incarnational actuality. I just want to do a little shout out to Zelensky. He and Biden stepped into their press conference at the exact moment of the winter solstice. We don't need to plan these things. We are them, you know, some trickster genius. And he did say that really great thing that I sent you in text. But he said, the Russian people will only be freed when they defeat the Kremlin in their minds. It's really great.
Exactly. You know, the conceptual breaking down and rewriting is super important, because if we just, you know, immediately accelerate into solutionism, we're going to rearticulate the same problem.
Oh, that's fun. Solutionism. Right. We want to take on lots of things, because I loved also when I said, well, it is ongoing solstice. What shall we toss into the cauldron? And what did you say? You said, I've got it down here. I'll toss the oppressive drive towards wellness and optimization. And I go, oh, this is fun. And I texted you back, to be liberated into what? What does anything want to be before being bamboozled? And you said, into dance and movement. I go, yes, liberatingly lovely. That's so great. You know, and I said, what do you want to ladle out? And you were like, mycorrhizal fungi, hermit crabs, reishi, and then something, I don't know if it's a betuloid rotifera.
My favorite microscopic worm, which I've been obsessed with, my parthenogenic asexual worm, betuloid rotifera.
Oh, that's so great.
So with my Virgin Mary. So if we're in the nativity season, my favorite Virgin Mary is actually a worm, an asexual worm called betuloid rotifera that reproduces asexually and should have gone extinct and has been kind of an evolutionary glitch in the theories of how asexuality decreases the diversity, genetic diversity. It's been unclear how it survived. But they found out that it actually creates genetic diversity by being desiccated and having its genetic, its DNA break down and then re-stitched when it becomes rehydrated. And for me, that feels like such an incredible lesson about trauma also. Like, we live in a moment when we're so fixated on, you know, safety and ease, and, you know, perhaps that shouldn't be the working goal. I mean, sometimes trauma has a habit of re-stitching us into a new type of diversity.
No, that's great. No, and late great ancestors, so many that we want to honor, and we will honor our mentors in all their forms. You know, but Peter Warshall, after he died, I went looking online for his lectures, and he gave a great lecture on beauty and danger in nature and how they always go together. Mm. And then he gives this great thing, and he goes, "That's why art openings are so boring. There's not enough danger to whereby to hone our skills, right?" So.
Exactly. I oftentimes say we must risk new shapes. There, you know, nothing new ever happens in a safe place. You have to risk losing your old body, your old ways of being, and jump.
Right. Well, we're very much like that. Well, because you said, you know, "I'm hopeless with astrology, but I love it." Never mind that. You are it, Sophie. You are Sagittarius. You know, the old language says ruled by Jupiter, but we throw rules out, right? Incarnational agent of Jupiter, which is curiosity, crossing borders, multiplicity of stories. And what I said, you know, extending widely, inhaling, collaging, and then putting forth. And you had said, we just entered a new Jupiter cycle, and I go, you would know, you are Jupiter, and you can see Jupiter overhead every night. It's so great. It's your teammate. So Jupiter just entered Aries, and you just spoke it, because it was for the longest time in Pisces with Neptune. They're the two hosts of the Piscean dream world. You know, all kinds of anything that's ever moved humans to goodness has been sort of surfacing and available, you know, but it's vast and large. And then yesterday, or the day before, Wednesday, Jupiter enters Aries, and it's like, all right, let's go. Let's do stuff. Let's take this knowledge and live it, which I think you just said.
Yeah, I'm ready to move. It's interesting. Wasn't the last time Jupiter was in Aries somewhere around 2010 or 2011?
Well, it's a 12-year cycle, yeah.
12-year cycle, yeah. That was when I fell life-threateningly ill. So it was really interesting for me to see that cycle and think, oh, that exactly maps onto this underworld journey. So perhaps I'm coming out of it. At least I'm gonna envision that. I'm gonna change that in my mind, to bring up Zelensky's quote that you summoned earlier. I'm gonna manifest that as someone who has spent a long time mythically, intellectually, physically in the underworld. It's time to sprout.
Right. No. It's very, and you know, backstage says, no, it's perfect. It's perfect. We'd be worried if you hadn't been desperately ill. You're right on schedule. it's the tale of Fatima the spinner in the tent. You know, I won't go into the whole thing, but it's a young woman who has tremendous misfortune, and underworld. And every time she makes peace with it, something else terrible happens. And she goes, and finally she's washed up on the shores of China, and she goes, oh, this is getting so old. But what she didn't know, and this we can apply this to yourself, is there was a legend in China that an amazing woman, storyteller, would appear on the shore and be able to build this incredible thing that everyone had heard about but no one had seen, called a tent, right? So they bring her to court, and she remembers all of her cataclysmic underworld experiences and goes, well, yeah, bring me this. Oh, we don't have that. Oh, I know how to do that. Bring me this. And makes the most fantastic tent. And the emperor says, anything you want, darling. And she says, well, I'll marry you for starters. And realizing that each cataclysmic underworld ordeal was building in some essential talent for the making of her ultimate happiness. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's so hard to see when you're in the midst of it, when you're in the water of it. But I do think that, you know, when you reach the top of the mountain, you can for a second look out at the valley. You can't stay at the summit for very long, though. Then you descend again into something else. So perhaps
today is the summit. It's part of your genius. I've been puzzling about, you know, who names generations, and you know, and when do the dates start and everything, you know, but we go, okay, you're a millennial, which starts in the years you were born. And then I go, is there something real to this? Well, when you were born in 1993, it's the Neptune-Uranus conjunction in Capricorn. I remember when you were born, because I woke up, I'm following these patterns, with a voice in my ear that said, we must liberate mythology and live it. And I go, oh, okay, that's what Neptune-Uranus says. You know, we're working on this forever. And it's like, you're doing it. And right now, that quality is coming alive. It's pragmatic mysticism and what you love embodied. It's like, if we know this, what do we do? But just one last thing, because you just spoke it. Capricorn's the sturdy mountain goat that can climb any mountain. And the issue is, what mountain? And very often we climb the top of the mountain and go, wrong mountain. I just climbed somebody
wrong
else's.
Mountain, exactly, yeah.
Right. Somebody else's idea of a relationship or work or whatever. But as you just said, from the wrong mountain, we can see Mount Sophie. It's like, all right, back down into the valley and back up the thing. And then so this perfect recycling. Jupiter says, you know, whatever you wanted to do 12 years ago, it wasn't time, but now it is.
Isn't, exactly.
It's
I
fun,
mean,
right?
Yeah. It's so interesting. I think of, you know, events in your life that could be categorized as being, you know, terrible have been like bottlenecks. They've acted like, you know, in evolution, there are these things called bottleneck, like extinction events that kill off most life and then leave open a lot of space. And then the left behind animals and beings diversify and experiment in that open space. I oftentimes say that human beings are not children of the garden, not children of Eden, but children of the crater, of the Chicxulub crater. You know, this extinction event that opened up the ecological niches whereby mammalian life experimented and created humans. And so I think about the open space that was created by these, you know, personal extinction events in my life. You know, mm-hmm. it led me into a narrower and narrower seriousness about certain things that I probably wouldn't have been delivered to without a certain kind of pressure and winnowing.
Wait, what do you mean? And the last sentence you said, an ongoing what?
Oh, I don't think I would have been delivered to this type of work that I'm doing now. I can see that now without these bottleneck events of becoming dramatically ill and really sick and having to give up on a lot of dreams and a lot of superficialities. But they were kind of extinction events in my life.
Right. No, I ran across, you know, pieces of paper and scraps of notes, and one said, trickster, close all the doors except the one you want me to walk through. I'm like,
close all the doors.
Except the one you want me to walk through. And that's very much Jupiter and Aries right now. It's like, out of all these possibilities, no, it's coming to us in dreams that we want to understand. But no, that's so great. So the other thing that I've been ruminating on, you know, and looking at the complexity of Zelensky and Ukraine and so many people going, and I go, well, people, there's a lot of story going on in everyone. And I wrote to myself, and here, this is very you, let's supplant the tyrannically tedious narrative norms of mainstream with liberating mythological narrative as among the most effective ways to participate in collective well-being. Because I look at somebody who flies from the Ukraine to Washington and steps out at the exact moment of the winter solstice with Biden, and then gives a pretty. This is complex, and we'll leave it because it's a whole other show and a backstage conversation I want to have with you. But there's a lot, you know, in him. We certainly do not love all the weapons and Lockheed Martin and all of that, you know, and we go, but here comes Trickster against all odds. It's in the Ukrainian fairy tales, their love of Trickster who pulls off against all things. Russian and Ukrainian fairy tales, very different. Ukrainian fairy tales are the unlikely hero who makes pacts with animals and creatures and whatever and pulls off the amazing thing against all odds. And the Russian fairy tales are more fate, like the dunderheaded younger brother is saved by a flounder or a woman and then gets, you know, punishes everybody. So I do want us to envision, you know, an against all odds, you know, you know, support of what Zelensky is in our collective dream. I love a colleague of ours and a friend of Stephen Buhner's, whom we'll get to as well, but who said, you know, remember in the war on Chechnya, the end began when the Russian mothers marched into Chechnya to take home their sons. And I go, like that. Let's just leave these openings, these impossible, nonviolent openings against all odds. But so there's that. But also Zelensky stepping out at the exact moment of the solstice, and in his talk he talked about light. Light always overcomes darkness. It's the solstice theme. You know, it's like, okay, so you know, just like our convening right now, you know, some genius is scheduling us, and it's perfect. You know, so what I'm gleaning from your book is, to liberate the mythological narrative, to liberate ourselves. It's so crucial.
Well, also,
I mean, to live this.
Liberate it, because liberation has a kind of theological or Christological undertone almost, which implies that, you know, there's some freedom or autonomy that we will be liberated to. There's some, you know, future destination. But I'm less interested in arrival or in liberation and much more in composting. How can we compost these narratives with darkness, with microbes, with fungi, to see if we can make some good soil that will grow something else? I think a lot of times I worry about the hubris of human storytelling, of this idea that we can manage ecosystems, that we can manage rivers that have lifetimes that make our Comet Streak human lifetimes look like just a blip. And so sometimes I think that we need to focus more on making the soil for other stories than on our own authorial power.
Yes, no, and I love that your dog has something to say about that.
I know. He's been very, very sick, so he has to be part of all these experiences. But I guess he kind of underlines my interspecies bent to all of my work.
Yeah, no, he was agreeing with you. Yes, listen to what she's saying. Right, we would be nothing without our animal allies.
Exactly.
So no dog.
We need our little,
no, your dog is super welcome. What is dog's name?
His name is Baba Ganoush, which I have been elucidated means spoiled little father, which feels appropriate. He is a very, very small Havanese. He weighs about 4 pounds.
And what does Baba Ganoush mean?
Baba Ganoush is spoiled little father, but it's a name for an eggplant dish that's kind of like hummus.
Yeah, I know that. Right. Yeah, no, we love it. Yum, 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 yum. Tasty. So your dog is tasty and goes well with PETA.
Yeah.
So I'm going to hold on to the word liberating just for fun because I like it so much. But I love you taking on everything. It's completely welcome going, and questioning,
We can take back liberation because, you know, liberation comes from the word leaper, which was the other name for Dionysus. The Dionysus that gets undermined by the Romans and turned into a drunk wino, but was actually the inspiration behind Bacula Ania and Spartacus and two of the most, you know, almost successful uprisings against the Roman Empire. So liberation does come from this, like, vegetal god liberatory energy.
And we can do etymology poker, which I love, which is the word deliberate comes from libra, and two verbs, libari, to liberate, there we go, and librari, to balance. So to be deliberate is to be in a state of liberating balance. Anyway, so I love that thing. I say that when I'm walking on slippery things, going deliberate, deliberate, deliberate.
Uh-huh.
Yes, and gecko feet. Yeah, shape-shifting and animals, I so welcome, right, the hubris of humanism being composted right into nutrient for the truth of animism. It's where we are in cahoots. Yes, exactly, that's very good. And we wish you well. You know what's been very good for my animals is medicinal mushrooms.
He's problematically a little bit of a mushroom forager. He can find mushrooms under any leaves. But my friend who runs Catskill Fungi was saying actually that, you know, dogs oftentimes eat poisonous mushrooms. So I'm trying to be a little careful about his fungal proclivities.
No, I get mine in a jar. But it's like, you know, my kitty had a malignant growth, as it turned out, even though she was quite young, and they took that away. And then they said, you might want to do chemo and things. And I go, no, I ran it by her. And then she had a slightly funky thing in her eye, and the vet said, just have the eye removed. And I go, no, we're going a different way. And we do the medicinal mushrooms, and her eye is all fine, and she's better, and she seems fine. Anyway, so, yes, all these things, practicing these things, but talking to the animals, going, do you want somebody to take out your eye? No. Okay, we'll do something else then.
No. Yeah. Yeah, and also he does, he's a little herbalist too. Like, he knows what he needs, you know? He had a bad reaction to a vaccine. I think his liver was a little overloaded, and he kept trying to eat dandelions. And I thought, dandelions can talk to your liver. Of course you want them. Let's make that happen.
Right. Right.
So he's very wise.
Oh, that's so great.
He's silly, but very wise.
Say that again, sorry. Say
he's
what?
Silly, but very wise.
That's the wise fool. The wise fool. Right. So here we are. Right. So Jupiter entered Aries for a whole new 12-year cycle for everybody. Going, let's live these things that we know. Let's apply them. And then we had the winter solstice last night. Very rousing, fun thing. It's available by tiny donation on coyotenetworknews.com with Michaela Gaston and Carolyn Brandy drumming. It was pretty great. And it reminds us of, you know, you go, you know, what shall we ladle out of the cauldron? And you said, you know, dancing and community and drumming and women drummers as well. And it's like, yes, and this is one of your big things, I so love collaborating, right? And you know, kind of yearning for more. But every time I do it, I go, I love this, you know. And you're calling for more community dancing, right?
Yeah. No. Sometimes I think that, you know, we're really kneecapped because we've been told by capitalism that healing belongs to an individual and it only happens in an individual body. But for most of human history, healing was an extended embodiment experience, but it happened in community. You know, just like we can see that spiders actually think with their whole webs, you know, there's been extended cognition experiments done that have shown that if you harm part of the web, the spider acts as if it has a stroke. And I sometimes think that, you know, we're like that too, but with our relationships, with our community, and with our critters and insects and fungi in our community. So if they're damaged, our extended body and mind is damaged. But if they're healed, you know, we might get some of that healing too. And I, you know, dance is an incredible way to begin to relax these patterns, the stuckness in our spirits, our psyches, and our bodies. But you can't do it alone. You have to do it with other people so you can disperse the pain, so you can let things kind of leak past your skin silhouette.
Well, do you have a team you dance with?
I have an unofficial team of people who I have festive experiences with, but I do not have a collective dance experience yet that fully satisfies my needs. So I'm putting the call out.
Oh, that's great. No, and excellent bonus points for using the magical word yet. It's a great small, I'm going to say liberating, but you can replace that word because it's like da-da-da-da-da. Yet. It just puts a key in the lock of the circle, right, to unlock it into available.
It will come.
That's good. It is coming now. I yearn for that, too. There was a lot, you know, I read in your book, The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine, that I go, yes, I want to call for that. I want more group dancing. And I told you also backstage that, like a spore, your book seems to be everywhere. I talked to two great men allies, you know, who don't know each other in different worlds, you know, but kinned. Yeah. One was like, I have that book right here. And another one said, I brought it to my men's entheo group, you know, and we on the day it came out. And I go, it's everywhere, right? So it's like a little living being, isn't it?
It is. And you kind of just have to let it go and let it be its own experience. I mean, I think that's the intense thing about a book is, you know, I'm a person who really believes that, you know, knowledge should be oral. It should be adaptive and refreshed every time it's spoken, and spoken into an audience of relationships that can respond and amend and change. So there is something about a book that frightens me a little bit, which is it immediately feels like a fossil, that it's this version of knowledge that could grow stale. But what I hope the book does is not offer some kind of ossified piece of knowledge, but inspire people to create their own experiences, tell their own stories. That I hope it keeps the mythological lymph moving in the narrative, like the narrative lymphatic system.
That's great. the lymph systems, they only move, right? They require motion.
Yeah, up and down. Exactly.
But it reminds me of something you said several miles back, about the ordeal. And I think it's an interesting question that I often pose myself and to others about something deeply difficult, an illness or a terrible death, and saying, would you rather this hadn't happened? And I mostly say, no, I wouldn't give it up.
I wouldn't give up anything that happened to me, because I've landed with my animal companion right here on this night, just tip past the solstice, that, I've been danced into place precisely. Being said, I wouldn't wish the violence I've experienced on anyone else. So I think that's what I always hold are the two things, which is I wouldn't have it be otherwise, but I also wouldn't ever give this to anyone.
Right. And when I say that or even think it, I do knock on wood to summon the protective tree spirits, because it's like, I think I got most of all the good out of that. I don't want to do it again. Right. I don't want to do it again.
Exactly.
I wouldn't release it, but I don't want to do it again. Okay. Anybody, any demons or gods or goddesses that are listening going, just checking. So yes. And then let's bring in, our moment, which your chart, your being, and your book so resonate with. So Chiron, little planetoid that really exists, is stationing now and will go forward, which is outward, on tomorrow's new moon. And Chiron, a lot of people call him the wounded healer, but Chiron's tired of that, because he's, it's true, he could heal where he's wounded, but he's like, don't fixate on that. The more important thing is he's the first mentor. He's a centaur. He's a half-horse guy. And he lives in a cave because he's a centaur. But he is he's the kindest and most cultivated of all beings. So he really represents the right relationship of wild nature and human culture. So he's stationing now at this solstice on the new moon. And mentors. And so I was asking to yourself, what mentors shall we welcome from the flora, fauna, fungi realms? You had some great answers, somewhere buried in our text. But who comes to mind now that you want to welcome?
Well, first, I also want to just note that Chiron represents one of my favorite mythological tropes, which dates all the way back to the cave paintings, 30,000 years ago, which are theriomorphs, theri for beast, morph to change, which are half man, half animal. And, I think there's a very Euro-patriarchal interpretation that says these are primitivist ideas, the sorcerer of Trois Frères, the lion man that was found in Germany. But I always suggest that they're inherently scientific, that they're incredibly factual, that they're pointing to our deep time evolutionary history as animals, to the symbiogenetic origin of our very cells, to the mergers, the half animal, the half man that create biological novelty. And so I do want to honor that Chiron represents our healthiest mythic themes that date all the way back to the cave paintings. Who are the mentors who I would call right now? I think I would call on hermit crabs. Can I tell a story about hermit crabs?
You can, but we're about to go to a very short or medium short musical break. So hold that story.
I will hold the hermit crab.
Yeah, hermit crabs. I'm writing it down. I'm putting my finger on top of it. Hermit crabs, when we return, our perfect for now guest, dance partner, is Sophie Strand. She's the author of The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine. And it's yeah. Yes, I'm putting my finger on many notes about what you've elicited, because as I read it, it teased forth a lot in me. that I'd forgotten that just sort of brought up to the surface, and we'll come back to that, like the NIMH story on men and light. All right, and we'll be right back after this Yaji Vezhna, one of my favorite pieces of music. Here we go.
Весна, где бывала весна, где бывала. В лесе зимовала, в лесе зимовала. Робила, что ты там робила? Город городила, город городила. Красочки садила, красочки садила. Вяночки крутила, вяночки крутила. Весна, где бывала весна, где бывала.
Welcome back to the Visionary Activist Show. That's one of my favorite pieces of music. Someone sent it to me decades ago. I don't know who, I don't know where, but I would dance with them. And it's Russian yearning for spring, but so soulful. And let's feel that emerging in the Russian soul, the deep, deep Russian soul. But our wonderful guest is Sophie Strand, author of The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine, and we're coming right back to hermit crabs as mentors.
Oh, yeah. I always say these days that we've been in guru culture for a long time, and we've looked to other human beings who are fallible for advice, and maybe it's time to turn to other beings for our mentors and our gurus. I've been learning a lot from hermit crabs that I learned that they do this kind of amazing thing, which is that when they don't make their own shells, they take them out of their environments and make them. And so when they outgrow one, when a hermit crab outgrows its shell, it usually finds another one that's not quite the right size. And instead of accepting that new shell that's not quite the right size, it leaves the first one and is fleshy and vulnerable and exposed, and it waits. It waits hours out in that dangerous exposed environment next to those two ill-fitted shells, and it waits for other hermit crabs to come and gather. And then finally, when there are enough hermit crabs gathered, they do something called a vacancy chain, and they all exchange shells so that every crab gets the right size shell. And I was thinking that it's a really great metaphor for what we can all help each other do narratively. Like, we're all trying to hospice stories in our life, like shells. Things that protected us, but we've outgrown. But it's, sometimes we immediately want to jump to the next shell, but the next shell is not the correct size. So how can we create spaces where we can exist in liminality together and then all exchange stories and help each other to shed and hospice these old ones and then find the next one? But that we don't accelerate through the difficulty. We stay in that vulnerable position of not being in a story, of living between stories, between shells.
That's great. No, and it's called vacancy exchange, right? I've seen some of the videos of the hermit crabs, and sometimes, like musical chairs, one guy gets left out. Everybody goes, I found a show that suits me just right, and it's like, oh, musical chairs, I got left. So, but it is charming and absolutely, you know, to humbly mentor with everything, you know, slime mold. I mean, Stamets is so good that way. I mean, all of it going, oh, and Stephen Buhner, let us praise him, right?
Yeah.
Because you loved him as I do, and he died on your birthday, which is a kind of handing the baton, you know? And
I noticed that. And, I mean, his books were really, really, really meaningful to me, especially Plants in the Imaginal Realm. I think that book is one I put on every course list of everything I ever do.
That's great. That's the one we offered in Fun Drive last week that I insisted, and the station manager was like, oh, okay. And it was the two shows that we did were about that book. It's so wonderful. And as you said, in your book, honoring Stephen's contribution, he was you know, curmudgeon-y and jaunty, and so anyway, the shows were so good. But he first came to my attention, you know, and you mentioned this too, when he says our whole attitude about invasive plants is unimaginative, and he said, right, the crucial thing, he said, I can walk around somebody's house and diagnose the illness of the person inside by looking at the weeds, because the weeds are showing up to heal them. And we love this.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, I think his work with Timothy Scott on invasives was really, really foundational to me. And also just complicating these fictional ideas of climactic ecosystems. That ecosystems have some kind of perfected state, and they're not constantly changing and adapting. That, you know, trees are migrating, flowers are migrating, that, you know, I just learned that spiders can, like, ride electromagnetic currents and migrate. Like, you know, life stays alive by intaking otherness, excreting itself, by constantly moving and adapting.
Right. No, and it is, you know, again, the work to which, you know, Buhner and yourself and, you know, many, many being biomimicry, Janine Benyus, is dedicated is really, it's the sine qua non. It's like humans humbly cooperating with nature's guiding genius. That's it. Or nothing, you know. And Buhner and many are such great guides, mentors, for being humbled by the intelligence of everything around us, you know. He said, trees, right, he guided us into the, in which we go, oh, you know, a tree, if it's munched on by beetles, which is increasing due to climate catastrophe, and he said the tree will put up with it for a while, and then until it crosses a boundary, a Saturn, and then,
yeah,
and then it goes, that's it. And the tree manufactures the pheromone of the predator of that beetle, but also, and here comes community, sends out a public service announcement to other trees going, rude beetles coming along, start manufacturing this now, right? We go, oh, that's... Yeah, so we want to be humbled. And then just one other thing I want to toss to you right now, which is that humans employing animals metaphorically to diss other humans only does disservice to the animals, right? You know, like an ostrich sticking its head in the sand. Ostriches do that to find water. It's not because they're ignoring the danger. Only humans do that, right? Anyway, I just want to hand that back to you.
Exactly.
Anything.
I mean, you know, the way that we infantilize or simplify nature says so much more about us than it does about the beings and the complexity that we're actually responding to. Those are the beings we need to look to right now for advice on how to stick our heads in the sand. But, you know, honestly, if we stuck our heads in the sand a little bit more and drove a little less, we'd probably make a bigger difference.
And find water.
I heard someone say that, like, you know, if every person in America just slept for 1 hour more, it would do more collectively to drop emissions than, like, any kind of activism. Just doing less.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're welcoming hermit crabs and then the mentors returning, and then something that speaks to your dedication as well. Because then what Chiron does, we have mythic figures, the ones I know most, Chiron and Ceres, who found actual initiatory human theater. So Chiron founds the Asclepions, which you reference really. And these are living places that are still spooky. These were places of dream incubation, healing, and theater. And so Chiron Stationing now says, let's make that available to humans who raise their hands right now. Yes, we're raising our hands. There we go. Because you speak about the dreaming, which suffuses your book, really, you know, but anything you want to welcome from the Asclepions returning?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have such a narrow framework for how knowledge arrives. We have like a very boundaried epistemological frame that says that, you know, only quantitative material reductionist approaches are real. But the truth is that dreaming was a highly recognized technology for so long. That it was that the dreams belonged to the land, and you went to a specific place to receive the dreams of the land, and that could help heal you, and it could also give you your vocation. It could help you find your ecological niche. And so I think it's really important to widen our lens of how knowledge arrives, that dreaming is a way of knowing, that just because you can't grasp it and can't explain it doesn't mean it's not highly accurate.
Right. Well, you have a whole great chapter on, yes, Joseph Vegetalista in the Bible.
Yeah, his prophetic. But the one thing that's important about him is his dreams are the dreams of plants. Well, you know, and of course, you know, the vegetalistas, the plant dreamers, so you see these in every culture, that there are the people who begin to dream of certain plants and be their interlocutor, their mouthpiece.
And that's Stephen Buhner's last book that he finished right before dying, Becoming Vegetalista.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it. I can't wait to read that book.
Right. So, well, that's a great chapter. That's a great chapter, Joseph, you know, dreaming plants. Plants dream us. And then I was writing things in the margin too. When I got to, you were getting, you know, disembodied, and I remember what I used to say to myself in, you know, what was it, European philosophy class. I go, I can't read Kant. I can't read Kant, because it was so disembodied. And it's like, well, this is what passes for aggressive intellectual banter. And it's like, and then here we go, you know, in a lot of, I don't know, we'll call it New Age maybe, you know, but, you know, there's, it's a lot of it's disembodied, you know, and people go on and on, and I go, where's the mango? Where's the sensual incarnational thing, which is the essence of all blessing? You know, it's got to be a mango, a path, a cloak, you know, not abstraction, right? And you work with this a lot.
Yeah, no, I mean, I only believe in gods that have roots, that, you know, I can see where they keep their brain, where they keep their relationships. I only believe in gods of matter and gods of place. I think that, you know, we owe to Platonism, then, which is then rearticulated and kind of Trojan horsed into Christianity, that mind and matter are separate. But the truth is that mind and matter are inherently interrelated in a way that cannot be picked apart. And so if we want to use our minds well, we have to use our matter well.
Yes. Mater, if we were good materialists, meaning honoring mother, you know, we'd actually be better. But you also,
I am a new materialist. I believe that every material is bumptious and agential, from the Mesozoic ferns turned into exhaust to the microplastics surfing through our bloodstream.
Right, and then I like also
with agency.
I stepped on that. Say it again.
No, I said the world is infused with agency.
What does that mean?
That means that many beings, many things that we wouldn't consider to be alive are part of narratives that move through us and use our bodies as side characters for plots we'll never be able to even see.
Right. Well, you know, it's like if we have an intense encounter with something that doesn't kill us, or then it's just this side of terror, like a small earthquake or a small hurricane or a small dance with the virus, which I had, then we can talk to it. You know, it,
yeah.
And it, it's like, you know, how are you? I don't mean to imply that, you know, I mean, people have had horrible experiences with COVID. I feel very blessed, and I knock on wood. I had a quirky but short, and then I got to talk with it going, since I'm your host, you know, is there anything you'd like? You know, it was like, it was very emphatic. It was like, we have heard about Mexican Coca-Cola. We'd really like that. I'm like, okay, right away. Oh, that really, that felt great. You know, and other things. And I go, what would you, and the conversing. But I also love when you just go, no more time for abstraction or moralizing. And it's like, okay, that's fun. And then you take us to slowing down and listening, which is part of conversing, right? And then I was so delighted to find that many versions of the Orpheus myth have happy endings.
They do. People don't know this, actually.
No.
I think the thing that we don't realize is that, you know, we live in a very narrow slice of human culture, but, you know, of human-ridden culture. And so the written myths that come to us are the last version of them ever written. That they had existed orally in cultures that were then subsumed by other cultures. You get a myth by game of telephone, and every time it's retold, it loses something. But you can look back into the distance and see that, you know, there were earlier versions of these myths that were healthier.
Right, and I forgot it was some smart person, I can't remember, but who said long ago. The Pluto and Persephone myth, many, many versions. And in one version, the Pluto character is named Pharmacia. And so it's not a guy who kidnaps a woman. It's plant medicine that takes us to a deep underworld place where our souls can speak to us. You go, right.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah. And then part of the timeliness, you know, because we it was very grown up, because when I called you first, we were like, I'm busy until December 22nd. I go, well, that's very grown up. We're scheduling ahead more than a month.
Uh-huh.
I'm becoming a grown up through the agency of Sophie. That's really good. But it is perfect because Mars in the sky, which we see, it's really red. You know, it's just to the left of Jupiter. We get to see the sky dance every night as a prayer. Saturn rises first, quite faint, but that's our dedication. This is a time of dedication. Then Jupiter rises, which is opportunity, and then Mars rises. Woof woof, let's do that. So every night we go dedication, magnetizes opportunity, and then here comes Mars. Woof woof. So Mars is retrograde in Gemini, which is called the Troubadour Bard, and retrograde is. Going, Mars is going on a vision quest, right? To remember, you know, the its true self. And in Gemini, it's going back, you know, Troubadour Bard, and you say, you know, men remember to sing, and retrieve all the lost songs, and then you say it has a lyre. Mars has a lyre right now, and I go, that's beautiful.
I like that idea a lot. Yeah, I think it's time to start singing again. And my dog starts singing as I say that. And to also use songs to step into the empty spaces created by anthropogenic extinction events. But, you know, there are birds. We talked about this in the first conversation we had. There are birds calling out for mates that will never arrive.
Yes,
We've created so much sound pollution that there are beings singing through like invisible smog of noise pollution who can't be heard. So how can we call back to them? How can we use our song to fill these spaces symbiotically?
Right. That's right. I guess I talked about my night blooming Sirius that I love and have had for years and years, but it blooms one night. Incredible. So fast. You can see it moving. It raises up this incredible closed flower and then unfurls and sends this incredibly sensual perfume through the neighborhood that is calling for its mate, a moth that no longer exists. I'm like, oh God, unfortunate dating life. But what you caused me to remember also is, you know, in I think the 90s, and NIMH did a study on women and men and hormones and the moon. And they said, well, women still hormonally track with the moon, even through artificial lighting, but men do not. And then they took men into prehistoric lighting conditions for 2 months, right, men who volunteered. And after 2 months of no artificial light, they were tracking hormonally with the moon again.
That's fascinating. I think the moon is such a great way to complicate this modern imperative to identify yourself. That instead of having to create one stable identity, what if you created one for every day of a 28-day lunar cycle? That, you know, we can lunate through different versions of ourselves rather than trying to, you know, capture ourselves in one increasingly concretized and fossil-like identity.
Right. Right. And so after reading that study, I used to get into trouble by going, so if we just keep men in the dark, we'll be better. And some humorless men were like, oh, enough man bashing. It's not man bashing. It's man healing. Give them the dark. And they anyway. So there's so much. We'll have to think of this as a beginning of an ongoing cahoot, because there's so much here. And we've still got some moments here. But where we are. Well, let's see. Well, I've got so many notes. I've got so many sticky notes in your book. But where we're in cahoots, you know, become like what we love, adopt their strategies to protect everything, right? To protect water, become like water. I love that. Yeah. You know, right. In your reference to Buhner and invasive species, you go like ivy. You know, may ivy encircle the hand that holds the sword. And it's like.
Yeah,
but I want to go back to Dionysus, right? And in that chapter, I'm not sure if you reference it, but since we're liberating everything, the women's Dionysian temple of initiation in Pompeii. Do you know this place?
I know a little bit about the Dionysian practices there. Yeah, no, it's where we have a lot of the best iconographic evidence of his story. There's a fresco there that shows Ariadne sitting in the throne with Dionysus sitting in her lap, which I love. I just love that so much.
Right. I do too. And I'm going to dust all these things off. I mean, I think that's one of the great things about your book is like, I'm going to go research. I'm going to go look that back up. I'm going to dust this book off. I'm going to go out into the woods. But the the women's initiation temple, Dionysian initiation temple in Pompeii, right, there's that image, but a lot of it is women being whipped, right? Women being whipped, like you have to be broken down to, and I go, I wonder if that's late.
I also think a lot of the reports you get of practices come from the people who are trying to explain why they were demonic, that you always have to be critical that, you know, of course, a lot of the accounts of the Celts come from the Roman oppressors. A lot of the accounts of the Dionysian rite come from the Roman senators and sympathizers who viewed it as a direct threat to their order. So they had a lot of reason to create these hyperbolic and oftentimes just like patently false accounts.
Right. Well, I'm going to go have to re-look up that book and everything. But more importantly than that for the moment is I loved your now I'm shy about using the word liberating. I'll try and find some other words.
It comes from Dionysus' name. Liber,
right.
Libation,
oh, good.
And liberation. Yeah.
Oh, that's fabulous. Okay.
Liber.
Okay. But you liberate the annoying bad boyfriend Theseus story and the Minotaur, and it's Dionysus who woos and heals the heartbroken Ariadne. I love that. Can you give us this story?
I think it's such a great story for all of us, which is, you know, Theseus gets Ariadne to betray her brother, to betray Crete, which is representative of goddess worship, partnership cultures that were nature reverent. And then he takes her away from her home, rapes her, and abandons her on the shores of Naxos. So we have like this classic patriarchal story, you know, a man comes in, you know, forces a woman to betray all her family, her values, and then, you know, leaves her abandoned. But instead of the tragedy, what we get is Dionysus comes down and he actually says, why would you want a man when you could have a god? When he gives her the Corona Borealis in the sky, he gives her a constellation, and he makes her a goddess again. And if we actually look at historically, Ariadne is probably the Lady of the Labyrinth, so the earlier Cretan pre-Greek earth goddess. So what he's really doing is he's making Ariadne, who's been simplified within a kind of hierarchical Greek culture, into a human princess. He's giving her back her role as the nature goddess. He's re-crowning her. But so that's a beautiful, beautiful healing story. But it also teaches us on a more practical, mundane level, you know, most women, non-binary trans people, have known some kind of sexual violence. What does it mean to come into a relationship with your lover in a way that you know that they've experienced harm? How can you approach the beloved with that knowledge?
In a Dionysian way. That's right. Well, because it's so resonant, you know, when you quote, you know, Dionysus is saying, why would you want a man when you can have a god? Say many women on dating sites. But it's also, it's like bad relationships, I think, happen because one inflates a less than adequate person with a mythological thing, and then experiences when they can't carry that, you know, like, oh, so, yeah. But it is, this is a longer conversation for another time, but it is the whole realm of obsession and sexual intensity and the desire to be overwhelmed, you know, erotically. It's a complicated thing, right, for feminists and all, but it's like, no, but not by a man, but by a divine force, by dancing, by something larger. No, it's not kind of a human thing. Anyway, in our waning seconds, do you want to open up a conversation? We'll have another time on that.
Well, yeah, the one thing I would say is maybe the issue right now is not saving ourselves or saving each other, but saving other beings. Like, let's always stop with the human supremacist conversation and look outside of our own narrative scope. But, you know, we have saved ourselves for a long time, and by saving ourselves, we've created a dystopia.
Right.
So perhaps we need to redirect our efforts towards, you know, helping a snapping turtle across the road, you know, like small scale. I'm not talking about like weird, like savior mentality stuff. I'm talking about like small scale experiences where you direct your attention towards making another being's aliveness easier.
Yes. That's wonderful. We're on our way out. Thank you so much, Sophie Strand, for your book, The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine. And we will, you know, keep our conversing to and fro, all worthy and pertinent, that we form alliances with what we love. Thank you so much. And thank you always, Kirsten Thomas, great board op. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com, and we will reconvene next week. Thanks, team. Thank you, Sophie.